Good day, everyone. This is Marge Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to my show on Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, and also available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. For first-time listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a monthly show revolving around local and international guest authors who talk with me about how they hope to see their fiction, memoir, or poetry play an effective role in society through their readers. Thank you all for tuning in today, and I dare say you are in for a treat, or at the very least, an unusual interview. Today, you'll be listening to my 12-year-old son, Jordy, as he interviews our guest author of the month, Danica Dinsmore. Jordy flew through Danica's fantasy series earlier this year, and upon finishing the third book, came to me in my office and said, "She better be writing another one." Thankfully, yes is the answer. And to ease Jordy's jitters on interview day, I arranged to have him chat with Danica casually at first, knowing I'd be using the material later for the interview. Partway through, I will be talking with Danica myself. But for now, welcome to Jordy's Soundcheck.
So talk.
Hello.
Talk a little bit louder.
And keep Hello.
Talking. Keep saying, like, tell me about your brother drowning you in the pool.
All right, my brother drowned me in the pool yesterday, but then I died because then I woke up, and then I was not dead because it was a dream. And then later on that day, I really died, but then I came back because it was a dream in a dream, and then I died for real.
Okay. A little bit more. More death. Bring on more death.
Death. I am going to die today.
That's good. That's good.
Hey.
And you can talk about the movie.
Movie? What
the books.
The movie. I wish it were a movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but the first book I originally wrote as a movie.
Really? You did?
I did. And then there was some interest in it, but the company that was interested in it wanted to make it animated, and I wasn't really excited about their style of animation.
Anime? Oh.
Yeah, and then I thought, no, this needs to be a live-action movie. And so I rewrote it as a novel, and then I thought, wow, this is a great world, and I want to explore it more. So I wrote a world book about the world and kept getting more and more stories. So I finally just outlined a whole series. I realized it was more than one book. So so sometimes when I go to school to visit, boys see the cover and they go, "Oh, fairies, I don't want to read that book." And then they read it and they realize, oh, it's not like Tinkerbell and, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking it was going to be sort of like that when I first
saw it. You had the same impression, huh?
Yeah.
But it wasn't. And let's see, who's your favorite character?
Favorite character. Let me think.
Did you read all three?
Yeah, I read all three.
That's right. Okay. Well, one of the reasons that Jarlath came for the second book is because I wanted to have a boy character that boys could relate to, too, so that they could have this friendship that continued for the whole series.
Yeah. I think my favorite character was, what was her name? The Treant?
Gola?
Gola.
Oh, I like Gola, too. That's why book three is a little sad, huh? I had my focus group who read it, which your mom suggested that you could be a part of, which would be great. What happens is when the book is...
Before it's officially sent out.
Before it's officially... before even that, before when I'm ready to have people look at it, I have a small group of people, usually parents and kids, who read it, and then they give me feedback before I do my final rewrite. So they get to kind of shape how, if there's anything, I want them to tell me if there's anything wrong with the story, if something is didn't understand, if I need to change anything. And they've been really great for the last three books in helping me to clarify anything or change something that they didn't think worked.
Cool.
And I remember that some of the people were like, "But not Gola!" And I'm like, "Well, I understand. It works with the story, but not Gola, not her, too." Well,
she was, I guessed when she first came in that she was going to die.
Well, she's quite old.
Yeah.
And what's really cool is the fourth book goes back in time. And it starts with Noreen, who you meet in book three, obviously.
Yeah.
And it starts with her, it opens with her witnessing Gola being born.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
Nice.
So then you realize truly how old Gola is and how much her story is entwined with the fairies. So,
what was your reasoning to start a book like for this?
A kind of a funny question because, well, originally it was a screenplay. So yeah. I was writing these stories that were sort of these small kind of, I don't know if you know what independent film means, but just these small sort of dramedies that might say go to a festival or something. But the agents I was with at the time, they said, can you write something bigger? And I was babysitting a shop. It was one of those shops where you go in and they have crystal balls and tarot cards and all that, and costuming for Renaissance fairs and things like that. And I was watching her shop, just sort of, you know, drifting around in my head. And I looked around and I realized I was surrounded by fairies. And what if you had fairies, but not Tinkerbell fairies, but fairies that went on an actual adventure, something that could be funny and scary and adventurous and fantastic and all this stuff, rather than just some kind of little girly Tinkerbell fairy. I wanted something that had a real story to it. So I just put that idea in my head, and I was literally cooking dinner one night, and suddenly Brigida and her sister just popped into my head, just out of the blue, pop. It was like they just sort of landed in my head. And and their sort of sisterly dynamic, you know, the way, I don't know if you've seen, you have brothers or sisters, you don't, do you?
I have one brother.
You have one brother. Is he younger or older?
Older.
Older. You kind of love each other, but you kind of bug each other at the same time.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's just the way it goes. Mm-hmm. So I saw that dynamic between them, you know. So I wrote it as a movie.
Animated.
Yeah, it just didn't feel right. And then I stopped writing screenplays, and now I'm just writing novels.
Here's another question. How did you come up with their names? Did something happen and you chose the names, or did you just come up with them?
Most of the time, names just pop up in my head. I love naming things. One of my favorite things to do is name things. And sometimes what I do is I go to a website called babynames.com, and I'll look in what the names and what the meanings of the names are. Sometimes I'll combine names, like I'll take two first names and I'll combine them to make a new name to make it sound more fantastic. Himalette just came to me. Brigida, I think I was looking on babynames.com, I think, and I saw Brigitte or something, and I came up with Brigida. Most of the names, I think, just appear in my head. I like to do things with sounds. You know, if it sounds like Hrothgar is a play on Beowulf. Is it Beowulf? Hrothgar was a male character, and I changed it to Hrothgar because I like the sound of it. It sounds very, you know, kind of like someone
Hrothgar.
Be afraid of,
That's also the name of one of the dwarf kings in Aragorn.
Hrothgar is?
Hrothgar.
Ah, interesting. That does come from some. Sometimes I think I'm being totally original with my names, and then I see them someplace else, and I'm like, oh.
Yeah. I really like the part in the third book. She's going towards the ocean, and they run. This is the first journey when they're sneaking away.
Mm-hmm.
And they run into the. They get split up. And one of the girls in that weird field with the mimic...
With the odd twin?
...thing. Yeah. And that, then the guy was somewhere else.
It's a little creepy, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is just... Yeah, just my brain. My weird, creepy brain.
And then there's that... They're near, really close to the ocean, and they're on that big stone thing. And there's that little, like, fish dude. What's his
Naru?
Name again?
Naru.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like him. He's sort of like the Mink of book three, isn't he?
Yeah.
It makes sense that they would become friends because they're sort of these lost, these kind of orphaned characters. I mean, he does have his family and his tribe, but they're really far away. And Mink has nobody. Like, he's never met
anybody. What happens to him in the fourth book?
What happens to who?
Mink. I mean, the fish guy.
Oh, well, you'll meet up with them again in the fifth book. Yeah. Because the fourth book goes back in time. So the fourth and the fifth book will probably come out closer together because people will want to know what happened from the third book. But in the, I had a friend of mine was very upset because when he got to the end of the third book, he says, but they're still outside the force and they're still separated. Like, yes, they are. You'll find out. He's like, but what happens? You'll find out. Trust me. I won't just leave you hanging. So yeah, they do meet up again and they do go journey. They actually in book five, they're going to be journeying across the ocean
and
what they're trying to ignite all the purviews, right?
Yeah. And there's, before Ondella dies, they're at the place and there's the evil queen, or not really evil queen, just the
mob.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really understand her.
Mob?
Yeah, she, like, mouth steal.
I didn't hear the last part you said.
She stole people's, like, voices and stuff.
Yeah, she had a bit of magic on her because she basically was an ancient fairy.
Yeah.
Who, and you meet her again in book four as well. She's older than she's meant to be because
so fairies, she doesn't die.
They're not meant to live forever. And what she basically has done, or what she basically did, was she kept herself alive with magic, which is a terrible thing to do. It's not natural. So that's why she's just sort of a little bit crazy. mostly blind. She sees with magic. She does kind of everything with magic. So
I like the idea of what's her name? The treant?
Gola.
She has her little, like, eyes.
Her eyeballs, yeah.
That was a good idea.
I don't know if you saw the, there's a book trailer we did for book one, and somebody built me some flying eyeballs.
That's really cool.
And that is the end of the sneaky part of the interview, and now we're on to the official show. Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to my show on Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time, at voiceofvashon.org, also available on archive, and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. For first-time listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a monthly show revolving around local and international guest authors who share with us how they see their fiction, memoir, or poetry playing an effective role in society through their readers. Thank you all for tuning in today as we do something new. Today, my son Jordy will be joining in on my interview with Donica Dinsmore. So, Jordy, how goes it today?
It goes good.
Are you all ready for the interview?
Yes, I am very ready.
It's going to be a little weird having headphones and speaking into a mic and trying not to move in your squeaky chair, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you wiggle around, I'll tap you to remind you, yeah?
Okay.
Okie doke. So I'm going to hand the headphones over to Jordy. But first, let me introduce our author. Danica Dinsmore is a fabulous children's author currently living in Canada, who I met at AWP in Seattle back in February. She was reading from her recently released third book in the White Forest series called Ondel of Grioth. I was so wrapped up in the excerpt that she read that I actually chased down the man who was in the room, who I think was her publisher, to buy one of the books. He had a couple extras with him. And I also picked up one of the advanced reader copies and went home and handed them off to my son, who sure enough tore through them in about one day, quickly asking for the third book. So this is our guest author, and Danica, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
And I'm glad we got the phone snafu handled.
Technology.
It's a blessing and... Yeah, exactly. So first off, we're going to let you and Jordy chat a bit about your lovely series with Brigitte and the White Forest and all sorts of other amazing characters. And let me hand over the headphones, and Jordy's going to take it away.
Hello, Donica. Thanks for talking.
Oh, absolutely.
I really like this series, but I've got questions. Is there a fourth book?
That's your first question. Yes, there actually, there's a fourth, fifth, and a sixth book.
Wow.
And yeah, and possibly, we'll see, a seventh book, because I've had lots of fans who have asked for a story about Brigida's little sister, Himalette, because she isn't as prevalent in the rest of the series, and there's a lot of fans that want her own story, her own coming-of-age adventure,
yeah,
like Brigida had. So if I can come up with something that would work, I might do that.
But
the fourth book is a little different, and I hope it doesn't throw fans off, because, as you know, book three, it's not exactly a cliffhanger, but it does leave you hanging a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the fourth book goes back in time to answer some questions before we continue the adventure. So we'll see what fans feel, how fans feel about that.
Yeah.
Does that interest you?
Yeah.
To find out how the White Force got started in the first place?
Yeah, that'd okay. be so cool.
Cool.
So when can I read the fourth book?
Well, it depends. There's different levels of access to the book. There's, of course, when it hits the shelves, which is the longest wait. That's no good, right? And then I have what are called advanced readers. That's what your mom became, because she picked up the advanced copy, which is the one that goes out for reviews before the final publication. But even before that, if you're really interested, I have what's called a focus group, and it's where I get young readers, young fans, maybe, you know, six or eight, and their parents, and they read the book before it even gets laid out by the publisher to help me with the story, to make sure I didn't leave anything out or make anything confusing, or sometimes continuity error. I might have said something in book one, and the more books you get into it, the harder it is to keep everything straight. So sometimes my focus group will say, I completely, when I was writing book three, left out the rings. Remember the rings that they got?
Yeah, the rings.
Yeah, I totally left that out in book three when I was writing it.
Oh.
And it was pointed out to me what happened to the... See, focus group readers are important.
Yeah. Well, here's another question. In book two, they go back to the ruins of No, and there's the ring... The big metal ring at the castle.
The purview.
The purview. And there were the smaller rings that the lizard things came through.
The Nords.
Nords.
Yeah.
How do they, like, are they, like, smaller versions or just, like, different?
No, they're literally rings. And what they do is the ancients were really the only ones who could get. They were the ones who created the purviews and the power to get through them through their own magic. If people haven't read the books, they might not understand some of these references. So for listeners, the imaginary world where these fairies live is an elemental chaos, and everything's disconnected in a world that used to be united and connected. And for the future, to reunite the world, they had left, they had taken one of the scepters, and they had broken it up, and they had created these rings, so that they wore on their fingers that had, you know, the magic of the scepter in them, so that they could get through the purview when the time came for them to reunite the world.
Yeah.
There is a plan in place, and that's part of book four, is you go back and you find out what was the original plan, and did things get messed up? Because the fairies, the current fairies, Brigida and even Andel and a couple others, they're confused about whether the plan is actually happening the way it's supposed to happen. And Corliss and Mob in book two kind of mess it up a little bit. So in book four, you find out what was the original plan that the ancients put forth to reunite the world. There's a lot of questions that I think will be answered in book four.
And Andela, we can take that out.
What was the question? Let's see.
Yeah, I'm thinking we probably don't want a spoiler in the interview necessarily.
I don't mind certain ones. That's a big one, though. What do you think?
Yeah.
Oh, I know a question for you, Jordy.
Oh.
So the audience, people assume that this book is for girls because it has fairies on it.
Yeah.
So what do you think, interests boys? Because I actually have a lot of boy fans, and people are for some reason surprised. What do you think about it attracts a boy audience?
There's a bit of fighting. That's what mostly would be it.
The fighting part?
Yeah.
And are boys interested in magic as well?
They probably liked the magic in the end, like stealing someone's voice.
That's pretty cool. Maybe the dragon, the rock dragons and the eternal dragon. There's two different kinds of dragons in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, anything where there's a little bit of darkness in it. It's not all whimsical and light. There's some dark parts of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, just curious.
All right.
Thanks, Dirty.
Okay, bye.
So that all looked really great. I wasn't able to hear it. I'm looking forward to editing because I'll get to hear the whole conversation. Thanks so much for chatting with Jordy. It looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now, how about we go ahead and shift a little bit to maybe more the adult writer's perspective. So sometimes people think kids' books are just, I don't know, just kids' books. But I have found, gosh, they seem to have like really intense, very clear, very deep morals and ethics and all sorts of things wrapped up in their stories. It's like that's the purpose of a book for children, really, is to suggest to them how people can be in the world.
And not be so overt with it. Do you know what I mean?
Like mm-hmm.
if kids know they're getting a lesson in, mm-hmm. like, I'm going to write this book so I can teach a lesson, it's not going to work. Ultimately, you have to tell a great story.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, you have to have great characters. And within that, I don't think anyone can help but their own perspective or viewpoints or philosophies or spirituality or whatever enter into it. I certainly see myself, you know, all over these
right.
books.
Right.
And,
yes.
And I think they actually say a lot about me. And what's interesting is that when I have a master's in writing and poetics,
mm-hmm.
and I went into poetry, and when I ended up in children's literature, there was a piece of me that felt like I was betraying my MFA because it wasn't serious literature. Right.
It
took a little while for me to come to terms with, but this is where I've landed, and this is where I'm having fun,
mm-hmm.
and this is where I'm doing the best work in the world, and why can't my mode of communication be through children's literature? It's not frivolous,
mm-hmm.
and everything that I'm about that's come before me in my history and my poetics and everything is feeding this as well. It just happens to be the form that it's coming from.
Well, and I would actually, I mean, like, that's really awesome that you bring up that perspective, because my first reaction is to say that's just not accurate. You know, that I know some other people personally who write children's literature, and it is a very competitive field, and it is not easy to write. It is not easy for adult-minded people to figure out how to write something in a way that it's going to be so exciting for the youthful mind, because it's a different type of mind. And so I think there's a tremendous amount of skill. I mean, granted, you have to shift your vocabulary in a particular direction because you're not dealing with people who have 40 years of developing their vocabulary, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and of course, then there's books that are written to adults that, like you said, there's eco-literature, which is the idea of writing fictional stories, for example, at the adult level, that will deal with something environmental, you know, veganism or whatever the deal is. And the same thing is true there. It's got to be story first, right? It's still got to be story first. No one wants to be lectured to in the middle of a fictional story.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think science fiction in general is, and there's a, you know, a glut of science fiction in the young adult market, even though people sometimes don't even realize they're reading science fiction. They think of science fiction, they think of, you know, just robots and technology and laser battles, but that's, you know, science fiction is, you know, simply, you know, when if it's technology, it's science fiction. If it's magic, it's fantasy. That's a very generalist, you know, kind of way of looking at things. But science fiction, which I have just taught in a high school here, is about possibility, and it's about taking what's happening now in our world and saying, you know, what is going to happen if we don't stop this? What is going to happen if we do nothing about the corporatization of water? What's going to happen if we don't do anything about global climate destabilization? What is going to happen if we don't do anything about the discrepancy of the rich and the poor and the have and the have-nots?
Right.
And it's thinking through that and addressing those issues through fiction, but in a way that calls attention to the issue at hand right now.
Yeah, you know, I think, what's that thing that they say? It's like, you know, playing it all the way out. Like someone will say, well, logically, I think blankety blank makes sense. And then the response is, okay, but have you played that all the way through to the possible conclusions? And it could do this, it could go here, it could go there, you know, all these unexpected, unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And yeah, exactly. Like what you're saying is, it is fiction anytime I think about what's going to happen next year, because it hasn't happened yet. It's my imagination. Wow, am I still going to be doing yoga? Will I be more flexible? Bam, that's a fictional story in my head that I'm running through and playing with the idea. And so like you say, yeah, I mean, dystopian is where we're saying if we fail to do well, how bad can it get? Utopian, if we succeed at reaching our goals, how great can it get? You know, and yeah, speculative fiction. It's a really interesting genre. It covers that, right? Fantasy and science fiction both fall under speculative fiction.
The three large genres under speculative fiction are science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And then beneath that, each of those genres have subgenres, which are really fun to play with. And dystopian generally falls under science fiction. You know, and then where do you put zombies? I don't know.
Like horror,
I guess. I put them under horror, but some people put them under fantasy. I guess it depends on how much bloodshed there is. I don't know.
Yeah, but, if it's zombies in love with each other.
The genres are being, what's exciting about the subgenres is that they're being blended and reformed and reconfigured and mixed up. I've seen science fantasy, and I've seen things that take, you know, steampunk and add some vampires to it, and there, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's just the possibilities are endless. And the cool thing about young adult literature is that the audience tends to be a little bit more forgiving and open when it comes to genre blending. Mm-hmm. Where in the adult market, and I'm generalizing, of course,
right
here.
Right.
They want things in like the genre to be the genre.
Right.
That, you know.
Well, young people have really flexible minds still. Mm-hmm. And while from an adult perspective, let's say you're trying to run a business and, you know, the kid's like flexible, which means they're flaky, right? Well, the reality is that there's also this tremendous gift in that flexibility. I mean, you know, their ability to see things differently than the way we see it, that is where evolution comes from. That's where change comes from, is a flexible mind. So, yeah, I'm looking at the books here. I have all three of your books here. So we have Brigitte of the White Forest, number one, and then The Ruins of No, number two, and then Andel of Griath. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
All three, perfect.
Awesome. So I'm curious, some authors, like Mrs. Piggywiggle, did you ever read those stories?
Long time ago.
Yeah. Oh, God, I loved them as a kid. I read them over and over and over again. Now I live on the island where they were written. It's amazing. I'm like, okay, full circle. But in Mrs. Pigglewiggle, you know what's going to happen. There's going to be kids that have really, you know, ridiculously obnoxious behaviors. They're going to meet Mrs. Pigglewiggle, have animal magical experiences, and realize life is better for them and others when they improve their behavior. And even though the kids know they're being lectured, somehow they were tremendously popular. So in general, it was like each book had a different issue that was being brought up. I'm curious if the themes that you have found intertwined in your novels
both on purpose and then just accidentally because they come out of who you are. Have you, like, chosen in each book to sort of, like, flesh out one theme or concept or idea that you want your readers to pick up, like, per book? Or is there just overall, like, you know, does loyalty span all the books? I mean, is there what is it that you're hoping your 11 or 12 or you know, year old reader is going to, like, take away subliminally from your stories?
Well, it's interesting you ask about the theme, because it wasn't – the themes came about organically. Mm-hmm. I did not set out to do anything in a certain theme. I think that they are themes that weave in and out of my own life, possibly. There's within the after the first book, I knew that there was going to be definitely a metaphysical aspect, and whether kids would pick up that or not, I don't know if they're picking up on that or not, or maybe they do, but they just don't have a name for it, because the people in my metaphysical realm definitely pick up on it. So there's that, and this idea that the world is in elemental chaos obviously reflects the world's condition currently, and the idea that we have to sort of unite in a common purpose, otherwise, you know, our world is going to end up in some. It's already happening, right?
Mm-hmm. It's everywhere, everywhere.
Floods and fires and all kinds of this, and that's reflected in the book too. And the point is that we have to find a balance in some way. There was a theme in the second one, and it might sound a horrible thing to say to a kid that there's no such thing as magic, but what she meant is that what you see happening in the world, like when you know, hundreds of years ago, they couldn't explain certain things about the world. Mm-hmm. They thought it was just magic. And Undell's trying to show Brigida that don't be afraid of what you see around you. There's a kind of an explanation for everything. But also, in order to manipulate in their way with, you know, quote-unquote magic, you have to be in balance and in flow with the world rather than against it and fighting it. So she's basically saying, if you see magic as just this thing that you want to use to manipulate others or to get something, it's not going to work for you. Mm-hmm. It's not. In order to truly see the magic and play with the magic around you, you have to be in communication or in community with what's around you, if that makes sense. So you are part of everything. This is kind of the metaphysical aspect,
right.
I guess, because I definitely believe that there's a, you know, that we're all connected in this higher consciousness, and as we put into it, that's what we receive. And so Andel's basically teaching her that you don't fight things, you don't grab after things, you don't try to control things or manipulate things. You live in the world at one with it. I guess that's the best way. It's kind of a
and that caught you by surprise. You
it didn't catch me by well. It just sort of appeared, but it made sense because it's part of what, like I said, it's just organically part of the way I like to live, in a way that I think that our culture has a tendency to sometimes, well, historically conquer the world, right?
Mm-hmm,
instead
right.
of being one with the world,
right.
As part of the world.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know what your childhood was like. I'm guessing you probably read a lot like I did.
Mm.
It's interesting, you know, you look back, and authors, of course, are coming from not just the time they live in, but also the time they were born in, their own lives. And so it's really, what I find is interesting, sort of the, you'd have like a swell on a chart that shows the life of the author, and then you'd have like set over 10 points to the right, the same swell that would show what people were writing about. So when I grew up, and I did a lot of reading, really started reading in the 80s, I was born in 72, I was reading works that had been written largely in the 70s, by Anne McCaffrey, for example.
Mm.
And this is an author who, you know, was born, I think, probably in the 40s, I'd imagine, and, you know, grew up through that time. And then so a lot of what the major theme of her work really was empowered women. I think you had feminism was coming into the world, and she was just envisioning a lot of women who came face to face with basically patriarchy and how they overcame it. Over and over and over, her characters overcome patriarchy. And so for me, as a girl growing up, falling in love with these characters and adoring them, I think I absorbed a real strong sense of feminism through them. I wasn't aware of what was happening in the magazines. I wasn't paying attention to the adult conversation around feminism and you know, women's rights and stuff. And that was like beyond me, but I really got it from the characters. So right now, my kids, they know there's stuff going on with the environment. I mean, we pretty much homeschool. The kids can choose to go to school if they want to. My older son's taking some classes at the high school by choice. And so we spend a lot of time interacting with our kids and talking to them about what's going on. And yet still, I can see they live mostly in the children's world, you know, and they have this understanding a little bit of what's going on in the adult conversation around global warming and stuff like that. But they're mostly focused on their children's world. So I would imagine that, you know, a storyline like yours, you know, Brigitte and everything that's going on with the White Forest and all the environmental issues, if you want to call it that, that's happening. My son, Jordy, probably got more out of your three books around that issue than he's going to get from listening to adults in his kitchen talking about global warming in the real world. He's going to pick up from the story this idea of, okay, well, you know, like you said, we need to come together. We need to face the issue. We need to not pretend it's not happening, not avoid it. Not, you know, he's going to really get that. And then 10, 15 years from now, when he's operating on the adult level, I would imagine his ethics around we need to work together are going to come strongly from fiction stories and characters that he walked the walk with them. He was in their shoes, walking with them and practicing how do you face reality and do something about it.
I think there's a lot to that, because I think when I think of my own childhood, and again, kids are growing up in a very different world, of course.
Yeah.
You and neither of us had the internet when we were kids or cell phones or whatnot. It felt very...
Or microwaves.
Well, not even a microwave. I think I was in high school and we got a microwave. It's sort of insulated, and it was a small terrain. Even though stuff that happened in the world affected us, I always use this example of, I remember the gas crisis, and you're a few years younger than I am, so I don't know if you remember this, but I remember during the gas crisis, the thing that affected me was that even numbered license plates could get gas on one day, and odd numbered license plates could get gas the next day, and we were really lucky because we had two cars, and one had an even numbered license plate, and one had an odd numbered license plate, and I remember sitting in line, and my dad's old Dodge, you know, sitting in line, this is like global problem, and then all I remember is just being in line and feeling lucky that we could fill one car one day and one car the other day, you know. That was my limited view of the world, sitting in the backseat of my dad's car.
But
I probably remember more about the books I read and the stories I read and the characters than I do about what was happening on a larger political or environmental or social agenda in the U.S. or in the world, I should say.
Yeah, it's been hitting me a lot recently, the power of story. There's some lovely women on the island who I get together with at the local coffee shop. They're all like in their 80s, most of them. And I just stumbled upon them because I had one friend who was already in the group, and we play this game called I think it's called Rummy Cube.
Rummy Cube, yes.
Yeah, okay. So we all show up. You know, it's 3 days of the week that someone will be there, and different people bring the game set, and there's a big round table. And we all show up. We all sit down, and we're cackling and playing Rummy Cube. Every once in a while, the barista has to come over and say, okay, you guys got to tone it down a bit.
That's funny.
And one of the women is leading a group about storytelling. It's giving people on the island a chance to get together, especially elders, and tell stories from their life. You know, so it's that and in your book, and there's just a lot of ways I've been hit lately. And then I went to our local Granny's, which is our local thrift store. It's fabulous. It's better than any thrift store in the world. It's Granny's is the best.
You'll have to come visit.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, they're moving, so come visit soon because they're moving to a new location. We're all really sad. But I walk in, and there's these boxes full of Life magazines from the 40s.
Wow.
And the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And I just stopped, and I'm like, oh, my husband will just
die with joy. And I took home 33 of these magazines. And it hit me again. I'm like, look at the story people were being told in America about Khrushchev. Look at the story they are being told about, you know, Rock Hudson. You know, the story they are being told. And now we have terrorism and the people in the Middle East. And, you know, 20 years ago, it was, you know, 25 years ago, it was Gorbachev. You know, and I started to think, wow, the power of story is, because we think when we read a newspaper article, that's not a story, that's fact. Oh, well, please. Like, so much of what's in the news media is absolutely a story.
Oh, yeah. Stories are, humans are storytelling machines.
Yeah.
I have the example of someone just comes home from work and they immediately go into story to their spouse about their day. Well, then this happened and then this happened. And if you talk about some experience on the bus, you have to, you know, exaggerate to make it more interesting so mm-hmm. that the truth of the story is still there, but you have to make it more interesting by adding things there. And you're just unloading, but you do it in the form of story.
Right.
We kind of just naturally go there.
Right. So your new book, tell me more about it.
It is, like I said, it's about 360 degrees different from what I've been working on the last, I don't know, 5 or 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a story that needed to be told, I guess, because it happened. But it's in a nutshell, it's a story about a girl who just sees the world in a different way. She's a bit introverted and doesn't quite understand the world around her. And she befriends a neighborhood girl who is, you know, not exactly the friend that her mom would have picked out for her.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of, she ends up having confused sexual feelings about this girl.
Mm-hmm.
And ends up having, there's a traumatic, I don't want to go into the traumatic event, which is, mm-hmm. There's a traumatic event that happens that sort of bonds them and her first intimate experiences with this girl,
mm-hmm.
Who ends up being pulled away by Child Protective Services and ends up in the foster system.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few years later, they meet up in high school, and the girl basically denies that this ever happened, and she and her friends begin to bully the girl.
Mm.
So this is such a combination of stories of things that I said, like, that happened to me, or I've witnessed, or to my friends or neighbors of people around me.
They're modern themes. I mean, all of that is stuff that people are grappling with a great deal right now.
Mm-hmm. It takes place in the 80s, which made authentic sense to me because that's when I grew up. And I also wanted to have a world, because people are so micro-connected these days,
mm-hmm.
it's really difficult for me to write a story where people are isolated.
Right.
Which
is the way it used to be.
Pardon?
I mean, that's the way it sort of used to be. You know, it's like if the other, the other day I said to my son, I said, well, why don't, you know, you ride over to so-and-so's house and just check and see if he's home, if he wants to get together. And my son looks at me and goes, well, isn't that rude to go to their house without calling first?
That's how we used to do it.
I know. And I was like, well, oh my gosh, the world of cell phones. I said, yeah, but kids never had phones before. And so that's what you just did. Like, someone would knock on the door and you'd peek out and they'd be there and they'd surprise you. And then, you know, wow, so, completely changing.
Pre-internet, pre-cell phone, pre-anything.
Yeah.
So when you wanted to make friends, you went over to somebody's house, and this girl can't function. She's a little bit, I was calling it the perks of being a wallflower for queer girls. That's originally kind of how I pictured it, but it's like its own complete story. And it's, like I said, there's so much of my own world that takes place in this,
mm-hmm.
in this story. But it's also, sometimes we use a story to tell a larger truth. There's a lot of truth in this story, though some of the facts are changed, right?
Right.
So, but it doesn't matter if the facts are changed, because this is the truth that I want to get at. The confusion of youth, the isolation, even when we're surrounded by people and support, who people think they're being supportive, how we could still feel alone and isolated because we don't fit in.
And lots of people feel the same way, no matter how popular they look or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I really try with my show, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, to bring out the value that comes from stories, because when a person's really feeling alone and they just cannot in any way at any moment connect with a real living human being in their community, it's just not going to happen. That book, that story, that character, the fictional story, it's just, it can be a lifesaver.
And even though the character is fiction, mm-hmm. they still feel connected because the author is somewhere in that character, and the author mm-hmm. must have understood that character in order to write that character, yep. so therefore the author must understand me. And yeah. I think that's
And
really
I'm not alone. I'm not alone. Here, mm-hmm. you know, here's this other character that went through this. I'm not alone. So you have three schools, and I believe you actually go to schools mm-hmm. and you talk about, you know, your stories, your books, and you, I'm not sure exactly what you do, but I'd love it if you would share with our listeners. We may have some PTSA members out there who might get inspired to call you up and have you come to the island at some point.
School visits are my favorite, and my absolutely hands down my favorite thing to do. Especially since I spend so much time alone, you know, in my room writing. So it's like, let's see what happens when I bring this out to the world. So it depends on the age level. Because I have a background in performing arts and in education, I have the ability to design curriculum that works from first grade all the way up through high school. Mm-hmm. And so I work really closely with the teachers in the schools and librarians and find out, well, you know, what is it that you want? But my favorite thing to do is a combination where I go into an elementary school, generally around fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, but I've done down to kindergarten. And I like, you know, the more the better, 200, 300 kids. And I do this interactive show, I guess, where mm-hmm. I get the kids in doing, you know, songs based on the book. I explain a little bit about the world that Brigida lives in, and then we talk about, you know, the elements of fantasy. They create their own animals, or animal mashups, imaginary creatures out of their imagination. Mm-hmm. Then I usually perform part of the book and then go back into some other interactive things. And the reason I love doing it with that age level is in a way that you can't do with older kids. Is that their just willingness to jump in and play. Like mm-hmm. if I say, all right, we're going to perform a Thunderbug symphony, and this
They're
half
like,
of the room is going to do this, yay, and this half is going to do this, yay. And then I say, okay, now, you know, make this sound and wiggle your butt, you know. And they'll just do it because
yeah.
they're just so willing.
I don't see the freshmen at the high school standing up making a sound and wiggling their butt.
No, it doesn't happen. I have adults that are willing to do it, and kids that are willing, but in high school, no, they just are so, and I understand, it's just, mm-hmm. you're so self-conscious in that, at that age level,
mm-hmm.
You know, figuring out who you are.
And vulnerable.
Yeah. Yes, and emotional and hormonal and all these other things. I remember, it's, mm-hmm. you know, I remember it. So then, generally, they'll pick a class, and after I do my assembly with all the kids, I sometimes do smaller workshops within the elementary school that are one or two classes that's called Building Imaginary Worlds, and we create, every student or in groups, they create imaginary worlds, and then, mm-hmm. and then I leave the teacher with supplemental information so they can create stories from their world. If they
right.
And again, the elementary school kids are just, boom, they're just 2 seconds into it. They're like, I'm ready to draw my world. Woo! You know?
Right. Well, we had a home. There's an outreach program called Family Link that offers, like, it's like public school support for homeschooling families mm-hmm, type mm-hmm. of thing. And we went to one of the classes once, and there was a woman who was like, okay, we're going to, you know, in 15 minutes, come up with this fabulous story, you know, as a group. And it was really interesting because, you know, stories are about the details, but they're also really about cliffhangers, or they're about tension. They're about, you know, the you know, moment, or what's going to happen next, or all that. And it was really fascinating. She just, it was like, you know, okay, pick a location. Someone's like, the ocean. She's like, great. You know, it didn't matter what they said. It all worked. Mm-hmm, and she's mm-hmm. like, okay, and then get halfway through the sentence and stop. And then, you know, and just by questions and tension, oh my gosh, at the end of like literally 10 or 15 minutes, all of us were like, we want that book. We want someone to flesh that out. It was like, we want to know what happens next. So I could see how the kids would really really get into that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With the,
as an assembly, mm-hmm. you're brave.
Yeah. With the, I get them all riled up, and then I send them back to their classrooms.
Oh, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, yeah.
With the high schoolers, I just finished a residency at a local high school, which is fantastic. They started with issues that were important to them, you know, whether they're environmental or social or anything political. And then they took those issues and they built science fiction stories around those issues. So they put them in either, you know, in a future Earth or a planet other than Earth or some completely imaginary world.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got the anthology in the mail and I'm so excited. I'm reading they put their log lines in the front under each title. I'm like, oh my gosh, they're brilliant. They were such a great class. You know, like sometimes because it's high school, I was wondering, are they getting this? Are they listening mm-hmm. to me? Because I'd ask them to share and they barely raise their hands or want to answer the questions and I don't want to answer them for them. And then
right.
when I see the final product, I'm like, okay, they were paying attention. They
right.
they got a lot out of it. They just weren't as, you know,
yeah.
forthcoming with enthusiasm like the elementary school kids are.
Right,
but
right,
they
right,
got
right.
it. They really got it.
It's amazing when kids write. I mean, I really wish more kids wrote because they have, like you say, less of the fear, less of the, you know, like an adult wants to write, they're like, I'm going to go read 15 books that are going to tell me how to write. Then I'll write my first sentence. And the kids are like, well, what if this happened? Boom, 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 boom. And then it's like art too. You know, someone will just sit down, do a drawing. And when someone else looks at someone else's drawing, when you look at something you didn't draw that someone else did, it's usually just so fascinating because it's so new and you never would have done it yourself. And it's exciting and yeah, it's hard to go wrong, really. Okay, so we have time for two things. My final question, which I'll save till the end. And then also, I'd love it if you would read an excerpt from trilogy at this point, but it's going to be is it going to be four or five books?
Six.
Oh, that's why Jordy's eyes lit up. I knew it was more than four when he asked you, and like his eyes got real big, and I thought, okay, it's got to be at least five. So, yeah, you have an excerpt prepared for us?
So I'm going to read a section that is sort of the setup, sort of the inciting incident, starting with the first book. So this is very early days. And it'll give you a little bit of sense of the flavor of it, the relationship between Brigida and her little sister, and a little bit of the small piece of the world.
Yeah.
I do want to say that the book do get, they start out much more whimsical, and as they go, they get darker.
I noticed. Yeah.
I call it the Harry Potterization of literature, because, you know, as your characters learn things about the world, they can't unlearn them.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go deeper into the story, it's a question I always ask of people, that as you go deeper into the story, does it necessarily get darker? And I think it's just sort of, that is the organic thing, because in life, as we go deeper into our, you know, soul searching or whatever you want to call it, life does kind of get a little bit darker, and then you can come on out on the other side and live a really joyful life, but there's always this sort of darkness that you get.
Right, you can't have the naivete
exactly.
of childhood forever.
So she's very naive at the beginning of the story because she has never left her forest before. And after she leaves her forest, she discovers that the outside world is not such a nice place. And when she comes back to the forest, she sees everyone as a lot more frivolous as she used to. And and so it's one of the reasons why she doesn't fit in anymore in her forest, because she's been out and seen things.
Right.
Even before she's ever left the forest.
This is not the tone for the entire series.
It'll give you a sense of, I wanted to get a little cliffhanger.
Well, and, you know, Jordy is, he'll be 13 soon, but Lord of the Rings, you know, lots of really intense material is really what he's usually interested in. And he loves the series. So, yeah, in the beginning, it's a gentle start, so to speak, but it definitely kept his interest very much so.
I do stay away from anything exceedingly graphic or sexual, because I wanted it to stay in solid, it's upper middle grade,
right.
But I wanted to stay in the middle grade and not venture into young adult, which is,
right.
you know, where that other stuff comes in, just so that parents kind of knew what they were getting. So
yeah.
Here they are. It's a few days before the Festival of Elements, and their parents are busy doing things, because Brigida's father is an inventor, and her mother's a feast master, and they've got this horrible, there was a mess to clean up, and her golden few, which is sort of like lentil stew, I guess, in the human world, got spoiled. So Brigida is interested in capturing these things called thunderbugs to use them in the festival. So she knows that they're attracted to fermented gundel beans, which is what Golden Few is made out of. So she's got this icky batch, which she has to get rid of. It's not festival worthy. So she drags her younger sister along because she has to look out for her. Her favorite thing to do, and she's going to use this Golden Few to capture some thunderbugs so that she can use them in the what she calls a Thunderbug Symphony, an invention of her father's. So, Brigida, and they live in village nests, which are, they're the villages, but they're in the trees, like giant nests. Mm-hmm. So, Brigida and Himmelet peered over the northern edge of Tiragero. The warm vat of Golden Few sat between them. Together they tipped it and spilled the stewy contents over the side. Himmelet squealed as it sloshed over the trees and bushes and onto the ground below. Brigida crouched down at the edge of the village nest, and Himmelet crawled up beside her. "Maybe they won't come," she said. "Maybe they don't like Golden Few anymore. Or maybe it's a specially bad batch." "Shh," Brigida silenced her sister. Himmelet leaned her chin out over the forest. She made soft popping sounds with her lips for a few moments, and then rolled over onto her back and stared at the patches of sky through the tree branches. A loud buzz careened past, and they both sat up. They watched and listened as hisses came in swarms from the river, sparkles came in flocks from the lilium field, and buzzes came in bursts from every other direction. A silent formation of tiny shadows flitted through the trees and landed on a stew-covered branch. "Shadow flies," Himmelet floated up on excited wings. Brigida yanked her back down. "We're waiting for the thunderbugs." On cue, there was a burst of little clashing beats, ricocheting off the trunks of the trees. Vibrating beasts of all different shapes, sizes, and colors made their way to the steamy mess below. All the other flying, blinking, and zipping beasts abandoned the meal and slipped back into the forest. Once the thunderbugs had polished off the stew, they settled into the branches to digest it, emitting a steady stream of drunken hiccups as they lazed and swayed. The fairy sisters left off the edge of the village nest and glided to the ground. Brigida examined four thunderbugs wobbling across the branch while Himmelet plucked a tiny yellow beast from a leaf and placed it in a jar. "Only the biggest and loudest ones, Himmy." Brigida pulled out the atomizer and sprayed a vivid pink bug with an enormous vibrating bottom. "I'm going to make up a song for the thunderbugs," declared Himmelet. "Thunderbugs, how you twinkle and shine, how you twinkle and shine." "Thunderbugs don't twinkle or shine." Brigida sprayed and plucked the drunken thunderbug from a branch and placed it in a jar, doing her best to pretend that Himmelet was in another world, one that was so far away that she couldn't be heard. She practiced her favorite ignoring technique, a hum that radiated from the space between her eyes. She hummed as she continued through the trees, spraying and plucking thunderbugs until she reached the lilium field. She placed the jar of bugs inside her pack and turned back toward Tiragero. "Himmelet!" Brigida called, then louder, "Himmelet!" Her voice echoed through the trees. "Hammy!" she growled. The sound of laughter danced in the air. Brigida followed the laughter into the trees until she came across a large fallen log that sounded suspiciously like a giggling young fairy. "Himmelet, come out of there," Brigida commanded. "I found a sprite! I found a sprite!" Himmelet called back from inside the log. "Leave it alone. She's pretty. Don't touch it!" Brigida climbed into the long, narrow log. She could see Himmelet farther down, illuminated by a blue light. Himmelet squealed, and then the light vanished. Brigida moved her pack and dug out her papa's globe light. She rubbed the globe a few times to charge it. After it lit up, she made her way through the log, scrunching down as it narrowed. She held the light up to Himmelet and gasped. The globe light flickered. Himmelet was blue from her face to her feet. Even her pink wings and blonde hair had blue tints to them. She waved her blue fingers in front of her eyes. "Oh, Himmelet, I told you not to touch it." Brigida shook her head. "You know sprites are full of stupid tricks." "She gave me her blue," Himmelet said, checking the underside of her arms. "What do you mean she gave you her blue?" "She gave me her blue, and then she went up there." Himmelet pointed to a hole in the top of the log. Brigida squinted up at it and saw nothing but forest and sky. "Come on, twerp. Maybe Papa can turn you back." Brigida smirked. "Maybe," she said under her breath. She turned to exit the log. Himmelet pouted and rubbed her shoulder against the rough interior. "Brigida, it itches," she whined. "Serves you right." Brigida grabbed Himmelet's hand. The warm blue instantly shot from Himmelet's hand up Brigida's arm all the way to her face. She could feel it spreading down to her body and her legs and finally her toes. "Oh, great. I should have left you tied to a tree." She pulled Himmelet toward the opening of the log. There was a bright flash, and somewhere outside a loud, low hum. The log trembled. The globe light went out. moment later, everything was dark and still. What was that? Asked Himmelit. I don't know. They quietly felt their way through the log. They emerged from the end and peered through the trees. Nothing looked any different, but there was something odd about the forest, something Brigida couldn't quite place. Out of water fairy instinct, they both looked to the sky. The sun was out, and there were very few clouds, and Brigida could feel no storm on the horizon. I'm scared, whispered Himmelit. Shh, said Brigida. I want to go home. Stay there. Himmelit sat on the mouth of the log, scratching her itchy blue face, while Brigida made her way back toward the lilium field. When she got there, it looked the same as it had before, but something was definitely wrong. After a moment, she realized what it was. The field was too still. There were no buzzing or flying beasts anywhere. Not one shadow fly, Brigida muttered as she looked across the field to the other side. Not one. Himmelit's screaming cut the silence, and Brigida raced back to the log to find her sister pressed up against it. What? Brigida shook Himmelit. What? Himmelit pointed to the ground with a trembling finger. The sprite lay there, motionless and gray. Brigida picked up a stick and poked at the sprite. It didn't budge. She bent down and touched it and retracted her blue hand in horror. It's turned to stone, she exclaimed. Brigida began to cry. Stop that, she scolded more harshly than she had intended. She opened her pack and pulled out one of the jars. Three stone thunderbugs sat inside. It was definitely some sort of sprite trickery, Brigida tried to convince herself. She'd make a complaint to the elders. She dropped the jar back in her pack and put it on so that it swung from the front. Come on, Lola, I'll carry you home. Himmelit sniffed as she climbed onto her sister's back and snuggled between her wings. She folded her own wings flat along her backside. As soon as Brigida was airborne and heading toward Tiragaro, an image of Andel's face interrupted her thoughts. The expression Andel had made, she suddenly realized what it meant. It was the look of someone who had just been warned. The last part is a little reference to Brigida had been spying on the elders, and Andel had made this sudden move and this weird gesture and had made this look, and Brigida was had been haunted by that look all day, going, I know that look meant something. So this is the first mystery, and it's not really giving anything away. When they get back to their village, everybody's turned to stone. Every single creature in the forest is turned to stone except for them, and they have no idea why.
But it's
really interesting as that blue reference of when they turn blue, like you really don't understand how that happened until book three.
Oh my goodness.
Like it's sort of left as a dangling mystery.
Right.
There's a lot of questions that people think are unanswered in books one, two, and three. And I'm like, I keep like my hand like a little evil scientist going, oh, just you wait, just you wait. The answer will be there. It's not a dangling mystery. I've got everything. I've got answers for everything.
Right.
And only I know.
And that's the joy of a series. It's when you say, oh, I'm going to write a series right now, a lot of people for some reason will say, oh, don't ever go to a publisher saying you have a series. They won't be interested.
It's, not anymore. Not so much. That was the old, it's changed
still,
a little bit.
I am still hearing this. And then I look at people, I'm like, have you been in a bookstore lately? All they're selling is series. Everything is a series as far as like young adult and things like that. So, but anyway, See, I love little pop, pop, pop you were doing with your voice. I mean, it's so cool. Yeah. I love how you've combined various arts together with teaching and yeah. Danica, thank you so much for reading
welcome.
That. And now I've got one final question
for
you. And, from the perspective of your protagonist, Brigida, if you want to answer in that way, or just from your own perspective as a normal human on Earth, what message of hope right now at a time where a lot of stories are being told about hopelessness, you know, and a lot of fear and a lot of predictions, what message of hope would you like to share with your listeners, young and old?
This is very... it's a very topical question because it's been a particularly tragic couple of weeks. There's been several shootings, Seattle, Portland, Vancouver, even like, which is for Canada, shootings are still big news, you know. And then that whole report about 74 school shootings in the last 18 months. And,
yeah,
you know, and the thing is, I still believe ultimately that human beings are basically good. That we all want the same thing. We all want peace, and we all want love, and we all want connection. And but that there are illnesses in the world, and I'm speaking, you know, literally and figuratively, and places where we are broken. However, because of the internet and the accessibility to story, I find that people are sharing also stories of hope and compassion and love. And all I have to do is go listen to some TED Talks and realize that there are people out there who are out of just because they feel necessary to do so, creating and inventing and inspiring things for the good of all. There are people out there doing the good work. And I think that we just need to practice living in a space of non-fear. I think that the U.S. in particular can be a culture of fear sometimes. And I think we need to say no to that. We will not fear each other or fear difference, and that we will continue to connect and make peace and make community. And but I just do. I see too many good stories to believe that any other. I refuse to believe any other way.
So in a way, what I hear you saying is, mainstream media may present only like, a small, tiny sliver of what's really going on in the world out there. But if that's what you see, you think it's everything that's going on in the world out there. And yet if you look yourself and you search around just a teeny weeny bit, you'll start to realize there's a lot of other stuff going on as well, a lot of positive things. Like Yes Magazine has
its
home.
There's so many positive websites now where people just, hey, I'm going to show you something good that's happening. News doesn't have to be bad news,
Right.
And I think people are gravitating towards that. They really want to feed themselves on these stories of, love and hope and generosity in big and small ways. So I just, it's there, and I have hope for the future because of this. We may have dug ourselves into a hole in some ways, but I know that we're smart and inventive people.
Right. So. And just there are some really amazing stories out there of people who, through love and compassion, so often the best social movements come from love and compassion. So whether it's the Dalai Lama or whether it's Martin Luther King or, it's not the people who get really angry, furious, and hateful that typically lead us towards a better place.
Right.
Yeah.
And as far as Brigida goes, she never stops. She feels a sense of responsibility towards her people and her world. And she's basically, sacrificing a lot and putting herself in danger quite a few times because she believes in this larger unification that needs to happen. She says, I'm going to just keep moving forward and doing this no matter who believes in me or not.
Right.
I feel this responsibility, and I sometimes feel that way too. I have a responsibility. And
right.
So.
But
thank you so much for having me and asking good questions.
And I so very much appreciate your willingness to share not only yourself and your time, but your work with the rest of us. It takes a lot of bravery to write down a story and then go out and take that risk of publishing it and, offering it to the world, finding a publisher and all that. And I'm excited. 3 more books coming down the pipeline. Yay.
It gets work.
Yeah, exactly. And so now for all of our listeners, I'd like to thank you for listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose here on Voice of Vashon. My name is March Twisdale, program host and producer. If you have a favorite author who inspires you to believe in yourself and the future, please send me an email and I will invite them to the show. Special appreciations to all of those who make Voice of Vashon the truly wondrous local radio station that it is. Don't forget that your VOV will soon find a spot on your FM dial. You can learn more about our approved application, our fundraising, and our Raise the Tower efforts at www.voiceofvashon.org. Finally, I truly cannot thank my guest authors enough for the passion and commitment which sustains them as they spend years at their writing desk so that we can be transported across the planet or into a fantastical land all over a weekend. And now here's our island's own Cami Lundin and her fabulous title song, Run Free, one more example of inspiration through art.
stands in the mountains, like the sun sets beyond the sea. Like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides, hides inside, that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy night. Why?